Welcome to Heart with Keisha B., the podcast that focuses on the journey of grief, healing, and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. Whether you're dealing with loss or life challenges, this is a podcast that you don't want to miss. I am your host, Keisha B. So take a deep breath, open your mind and your soul, and sit back as we embark on this journey together. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Heart to Heart with Keisha B. I am so excited to know that we have an opportunity to be empowered and inspired by someone else here who will understand the importance of healing throughout grief and unforeseen circumstances. This week's episode is From Love to Loss, a widow's story of grief, isolation, and finding strength. Today, our guest is Bethel Stevens, author of the brand new published book, Not a Cinderella Story, a powerful story of love, loss, and perseverance when life goes off script. She is an author, a speaker, and a mental health advocate who shares her personal journey through loss and grief as a young widow, aiming to inspire others to reimagine their dreams and live with hope, purpose, and resilience. With a keen interest in neuroscience, Bethel integrates insights from bereavement science to element the cognitive aspects of grieving process. A first-generation Ethiopian American who resides in Washington, D.C. with her beloved pug, Prince. Hello, Bethel. How are you today?
Hi, Keisha. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am magnificent and even more excited to have you as one of our guests this week on Heart to Heart with Keisha B. I see here and hearing a little bit about you that you are a woman of perseverance and inspiration. So Bethel, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me, Keisha. As you pointed out in my bio there, my story was a journey that I did not anticipate, but a lot of life's tragedies end up that way. I got married at 26 and became a widow at 33. My husband was diagnosed with a rare form of adrenal cancer just weeks after our wedding. And, you know, years of battling that illness ultimately resulted in him losing that fight against cancer. And I found myself as a widow at 33. Mm-hmm. I'm 37 now. So it's been 3.5 years out from that event. And it's been quite the journey. And I'm sure we'll get into it. But that is it in a nutshell.
My heart pours out to you. And I know that this can be a very touchy subject and a very emotional subject. But what I know is, as I sit here on the other end, I understand how impactful and how beneficial this story will be to other widows who are also grieving the loss of their loved one. And so as we move forward into this conversation, I'm ready to hear what you have to give to us today. So Bethel, as I hear you say that your husband early on in your marriage, you learned that he had been diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. Can you tell us about when you learned of this information, how that was for you and your husband?
Sure. And as you read, the title of my book is Not a Cinderella Story, because our story together very much felt like a fairy tale to me. Mm-hmm. When I met David Stevens, I was completely swept off my feet. It was one of those things that felt like everything aligned and our worlds kind of unseemingly collided so that we could find each other. And it was, you know, whatever the great love is that we hear about, that you, when yes, you know thing, all of it made sense when I met David. So he was just a wonderful, special human being. And we got engaged 9 months after meeting, got married shortly after that. And within 4 or 5 weeks, and I talk about this in detail in the book, that is when things started to go astray with him not feeling well. And eventually it was diagnosed as cancer. So it happened very, very early on in our marriage.
When you think back to that, is there like any emotions or feelings that immediately hit your brain when you heard this news?
That this can't be real. Yeah. Right. This doesn't happen. This right. absolutely doesn't happen. We're supposed to be newlyweds, right? We, prior to that, our conversations, it seems, you know, silly now, but whether or not we need to have, you know, two kids or three and, you know, planning all this out, right? As young couples do and dreaming about starting life together. And so that was just this violent interruption to life. And you struggle with reconciling it, where you hear it, but it's hard to internalize, right? So you're fighting it every step of the way while still going through the things that need to be done. So that's the only way I can kind of describe it. It was definitely hard.
And I'm sure, I mean, if I can put myself that that's fair, somewhat in your shoes, there had to be some fear.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so often we as people, when we receive news that we're quite not ready for, especially when it's hard news that you don't have time to really process, the first thing your mind goes to is probably fight or flight. And you're probably thinking, how do I navigate this unknown when I'm still trying to get used to the new of being married?
Right. And honestly, Keisha, there was no time to ponder or process even because immediately after the diagnosis, it was, you need to schedule surgery. It was an invasive surgery, a very serious procedure that took about 8 hours, actually. And so you kind of live off adrenaline for the most part, because it's crisis management. This is life or death. You don't have time to sit and think about and mull over things. You just spring into action. And that's kind of what we did. 2 months in, surgery happened. And then there were, you know, a few months, 3, 4, 5 months of recovery time, because again, it was a pretty evasive surgery that he had to undergo. And initially going into surgery, the doctors had actually thought it was a benign tumor. So it wasn't until after surgery we were told, actually, we've, you know, this is metastatic. And it was a very rare kind of cancer. They didn't expect it to have spread, but it did. The first year, you know, he was still in high hopes. We were still very much trying to stick to our plan, right? And just looking at things as, you know what, this is a challenge. We're going to get through this together. We leaned a lot on our faith. And so, but it didn't stop there, right? You know, we got through one hurdle. There'd be a period of time where you kind of get a break, and then something else would happen. And then there would be another medical emergency. And not to get too much into the story itself, but this lasted, Keisha, for 6.5 years of one medical emergency after another. When, you know, eventually my husband had deteriorated so much, he was in a wheelchair. But I watched as the man I love, just married, suffered and deteriorated slowly, painfully. So that was hard, but that's what happened. And you, at that point, you kind of don't have anything else to hold on to but your faith, right? And that absolutely, I think, was the only thing that helped me get through and not completely break down, because I had to be strong for him as well. But there's the suffering of being helpless too, as you're watching somebody suffer.
So Beth, I think you bring up a good point when you speak of being strong for David.
Yeah.
How was that for Bethel and her mental health as she was being strong for David?
Not good. It's one of those things, and it's the same on the other side as a widow. But in your late 20s, as you're trying to maneuver marriage and sickness and all of these other things and being a caretaker, this is not a common event. So it's not as if there was a peer group to talk to about this kind of thing. So it was very isolating going through that, through those years. And yeah, but you try to hold on to hope, to some, you know, hope that there would be a miracle, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just was my focus. And that's what kept me going.
I was about to ask that question that, you know, was that your way to cope? Is just holding on to the hope.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me, of just being able to find just something just to keep you as strong as you possibly can, because, you know, on the other side, your husband's still looking at you for the strength that he also needs as well.
Yeah. And we, I think we did that for each other. He tried to be strong. I think there was only one or two times that I ever saw him get really emotional, at least in front of me. Right. And I did the same thing. I would feel something or see him struggle, and I would tell myself, keep it together. Right. And maybe I would go lock myself in the bathroom in the shower where he can't hear me sob. But I think, yeah, there was times where I think we both tried to be strong for each other.
Right. What I hear you saying is that y'all were there for each other, even though both of y'all were suffering.
Yeah.
In your own way.
Mm-hmm.
As we talk about having hope and being there for one another, there then becomes a time throughout your journey that things begin to look a little bit different for you. Do you mind sharing those things with us?
Sure. So David went into the hospital, you know, and we have these hospital visits so often, except this time, it was May of 2021. So it's at the height of COVID. And I actually was not even allowed to accompany him in. He had to undergo, you know, additional procedures. And a few weeks later is when he passed. And I think up until that point, you're trying to hold it together, right? Because there's still that sliver of hope, that finality of death. It almost broke me, because there was nothing else to hope for. That's when your worst fear is realized. And it was on that day. It was absolutely the worst day of my life. And it was one of those things, Keisha, that I thought, why would God allow me to meet my husband just so I can slowly watch him die? And I struggled with that for a long time. And there's still no answer, obviously. Right. I just ask different questions now, but that's where I parked. Right. And for a long time I was stuck. I questioned everything. I questioned faith. I questioned meaning. I questioned a lot of things, and tragedy has a way of doing that.
I was just about to say that, Bethel, because I know when we first start talking, what you share with us is that faith kept you going.
Yeah.
And then as soon as tragedy happened, it's like, faith, are you really here? Like, what does faith really mean? That's what it sounds like to me. And I think so often with grief, right, because there's so many different stages of grief, that it does cause one to question their faith, something they had held on to so long, for so many reasons prior to the tragedy occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So Bethel, I want to touch on the subject that I know that when you and I first met and had opportunity to talk, that you talked to me about. And it was about this being the first funeral that you had ever been to.
Yeah.
Outside of just being in a place of isolation, hurt, I'm sure all these different emotions, then there's this next unfamiliar aspect that you were faced with. Share what that was like for Bethel.
Yeah. So being initiated into grief was interesting. Obviously, up until that point, I have dealt with challenges, hardships, obstacles, sickness, losses, right? Mm-hmm. One of which is, you know, not being able to have a family, right? There's so many losses tied to sickness that you yes. have to acknowledge. But the grief that I got introduced to once David did pass was something completely different. Mm-hmm. And whatever I thought I knew about grief, what I actually experienced was a lot different. It was more than just being sad or depressed. Grief, I found, was violent. It came in waves that were involuntary, right? You mm-hmm. couldn't control it. It was one of those things where I just had to learn to surrender to it, right? Because it's so overwhelming. It's mm-hmm. not just one emotion. Sometimes it's so many different things at one time. So it was so disorienting experiencing that kind of grief. And one of the things that I struggled with, and you know, in the book, I cite a lot of research on the experience of young widows, because they found that young widows have a heightened risk of poor adjustment compared to older widows. Because okay. like me, they haven't experienced a close death before, right? Mm-hmm. I had not been to a funeral before, right? There was a lot of things that were new to me that I was going through for the first time with the person that was closest to me. And that was such intense pain, such intense emotion. It's so hard to articulate now, but I spent so much time documenting that process for me in the book. Mm-hmm. Because even your brain is like, this is out of sequence, right? This is mm-hmm. out of sequence. It doesn't happen now. So your brain has trouble reconciling things, and it takes a long time to even mm-hmm. adapt to the reality that you're actually living in. You kind of have to catch up, right?
Right.
Those were some of the challenges that I experienced as I, you know, now had to live in this new reality, and also accept the fact that the future as I had imagined it with the person I had planned it with is no longer a possibility, right? Mm-hmm. It's not right. tweaks and adjustments. No, you have to throw that whole thing out. It just took a lot of time to navigate those feelings, understand what's going on, mm-hmm. and then eventually get to a place where I have to sort of accept those things that are never going to be and reimagine a future, mm-hmm. a different future, mm-hmm. because that was the only way I could move forward.
You bring up a good point, Bethel. As you know, and as you stated, grief is tricky, right? Like, it's not linear. You know, when you're not expecting, all these different emotions just happen, right? There's no certain yeah. order they come in, even though I often say this, they say stages, but they really don't come in stages. They come in waves, right? So at what point through your grief process did you get to the point of accepting?
I think when I'm thinking about a pivotal moment, it was about a year and a couple of months in, because for a long time, especially when I'm in isolation and I'm just having conversations, circular conversations by myself with myself, mm-hmm. there's only so much you could process, right?
Right.
There's only so much you can, you know, kind of put into place and organize yourself, your thoughts, to then mm-hmm. try to move on to the next thing. And I couldn't do that by myself. That was one, but I definitely tried it. mm-hmm. But a year and some change after, I took a hard look at myself and I thought, here I am stuck. because I'm at a dead end and I'm refusing to look anywhere else except this wall in front of me. I actually, in the book, there's the diagram I drew, very simplistic, but this was my thought process. It's in the book. I drew a diagram and it was a line diagram, very simple, vertical axis was the highs and lows. Okay. And I'm drawing that line, right? And the highest point was my wedding day, right? It was the best day of my life. And then, you know, I'm noting things as David deteriorated and things seemed hopeless. And then right here, I put a star and I said, right here, right now. And that signifies where I was in that very moment. I was drawing this diagram and it was at the lowest point so far in my life. Right. And I told myself, simplistic view, but you have three options. I could just maintain status quo. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just treading water. And I lived a life where I did the things I was supposed to. I showed up, but I wasn't present.
I get it.
Yeah. And I could live my life that way. And it was almost like a second death, right? I'm physically here, but I'm really not.
Right. It's like a shell.
Exactly. Yeah. The second option is, let's see how far down this thing goes, right? Because there's always another low, right? Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was under the careful watch of my parents. I actually moved in with them. I was isolated, but not really engaging in any self-destructive behavior. I was more so just detached, right? But very much still checking the boxes of, you know, pay my bills, doing my work, whatever I had to get done, still got done. There was still the possibility that I can make a different decision and things could get worse, right? Just that's always possible. Right. Then the third option is, what if I got up from this dead end, this wall in front of me, and just turned, right? And what if I chose to go that direction or that direction? Because it's not that there weren't any other paths. I was like, no, I wanted to go this way and I'm refusing to move, right? Mm-hmm. And what does that look like? Maybe that looked like thinking about a new dream, a new goal. What if I had to just stop and think, what is one thing that I've thought about doing that I kind of want to do? And what would that look like, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, that was moving back to Washington, D.C. I was in Atlanta at the time. And I was like, what if I just bought a house in that neighborhood I like? Or just something completely different, right? That I never thought to do before. But I was like, you know what? I have nothing else left to lose. So I'm just going to think of something and just go after it, because what else do I have to lose, right? Then that was that chip on my shoulder kind of thing. That was that pivotal moment for me.
Let me applaud you for the work that you did to work through grief and the irrational thoughts that come with grief. And so that leads me to ask, as you worked through this, did you do this based upon Bethel's thoughts? Did you have assistance from family, professionals, or was this just Bethel?
No, it definitely wasn't just me. So I saw a grief counselor for, I think, about a year.
Okay.
I saw her once a week. As much as I deeply love my parents and my family members, it was helpful to have a third party where I can express some of the thoughts, some of the pain, some of the things I would never say to my parents, right? Because it was hard enough to be around them and I'm seeing their hearts breaking because I'm always sad or crying, right? So for me, the grief counselor was absolutely helpful because I could talk and say whatever it is I needed to say and let out without judgment.
Yeah. That's right? The key word, without judgment. Yeah.
Or without the fear of hurting somebody like my parents, because, you know, they care and love you. They don't, they want to fix it. The reflex that they have is like, oh, we want to fix it. No, I just want to tell you how broken I am without you needing to fix it. Right. Just somebody to hear me, and having that safe space to let it out on a regular basis was helpful for me.
So Beth, I want to ask you, as a widow, were there any specific moments or experiences that made you feel especially uncomfortable in your grief? And if so, how did you handle those moments?
Uncomfortable. I mean, I don't think there was any part that was comfortable, but I will say this. I felt that there were some people I came across who had the misconception that somehow because I was young, right? Mm-hmm. The average widow, by the way, is 59. Mm-hmm. So because I was relatively young, that somehow I would, quote, bounce back quicker or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. I felt pressure to move on, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that level of expectation that quickly would have been placed on somebody older, but I certainly felt it for multiple places. And that just made me retreat even more.
Of course.
Because like I just mentioned, the research shows that younger widows have more instances of prolonged grief because you're dealing with a lot of firsts and you're not mm-hmm. mentally prepared for things. I think that kind of added to that feeling of isolation.
So Bethel, you brought up a good point of people thinking that you should just move on because you were younger. Was there ever a time that someone may have even said that to you, being that you were so young?
Yeah. And not to give it away, but I'm going to say it here in the book. I mentioned a specific instance when somebody said that to me at the funeral.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's tough. Mm-hmm. And definitely doesn't make one feel better.
No.
There's never, let's be real here, right? There's never the right time or a time that anyone should tell someone who's grieving to move on. And definitely not at a funeral.
Yeah. And to be fair, those weren't the exact words used, but the conversation was, how old are you? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You'll be fine. Connecting mm-hmm. the two, right? Mm-hmm. But there were other instances after that as well. It also made me question, is there something wrong with me? Am I not getting something here? Mm-hmm. Is it me that's just taking a long time? So I was judging my own grieving process based on some of the pressure I felt.
I get it. You know, Bethel, as you and I have spoken before, when it comes to losing a loved one, especially your significant other, your lover, it's hard sometimes to even explain to people. In 2018, I lost my significant other. And so I know when you had talked about just walking in a shell, even though you're moving in places, right? But it's like your heart, your soul, and your feelings are left in one setting, and your shell is just walking in other settings. And, you know, no matter what someone says, no matter what someone does, I can remember many of days just thinking, excuse my language, but what the hell is going on? Where the hell am I? And where the hell am I going, right? Mm-hmm. Because I just was so lost because someone whom I had loved for so long and still do love, I just was not prepared to lose that person. So I definitely understand what you mean in regards to walking as a shell. Mm-hmm. We're going to circle back a little bit. As you talked about being isolated when David was ill and you were there to support him, what was the most challenging part of just being isolated?
There is a quote I heard that rings so true, which is, it's not the mere fact that we are suffering, but our suffering is heightened because we feel like we are all alone in it and that nobody understands. And so I can only describe it as being in solitary confinement in this dark box and you're stumbling around all alone. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that feeling of isolation doesn't necessarily have to do with having a warm body around, right? Because again, when you feel like the people around you don't understand, mm-hmm. that's the real cause of that isolation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe a few months into widowhood, I actually connected with an old friend I had not spoken to in 15 years. And I don't believe in coincidences, but it just so happened that that friend, same age, had lost her husband 2 months before I had. And she would end up being the person I talked to frequently because there was just something about somebody who can say, I've been there, I know what you're going through, and this is what helped me, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really part of the purpose of the book for anybody who finds themselves dealing with unimaginable tragedy, where the only thing people can say is, oh, I can't imagine, which, you know what, there's nothing else to say. So so you kind of feel like you're on this island by yourself. Mm-hmm. But I really hope that this book serves more as a bridge for anybody who kind of can relate to this type of pain and isolation and feeling invisible while still being surrounded as you're dealing with loss and grief and all of these things for the first time.
Many times on some of my platforms, I do a series of what not to say or what not to do when you're interacting with someone who's grieving. And one of the things that you just said, I remember speaking about, I couldn't imagine being in your shoes. And I remember saying in my series of, and I wouldn't want you to imagine what it's like to be in my shoes. Yeah. And I think so often as people, this is just normal conversation, right? Regardless of what the scenario or the situation may be, sometimes we find ourselves interacting with people who may say things because they don't know what to say.
Yeah.
And what I've learned in this grief cycle and this grief process myself is that sometimes saying nothing is better than saying something. Sometimes we just need people to be beside us, whether it's because we want to cry or whether it's because we just need someone to listen as we process sometimes what may be irrational thoughts or irrational feelings, you know? Mm-hmm. And so if there's a message alongside of what you're sharing today, Bethel, is getting people to understand that sometimes when we're grieving, we don't need people to say anything.
And I'm so glad you said that. I will say that a lot of people in my life disappeared soon after the funeral. Mm-hmm. And I am almost certain it's because they didn't know what to say. And before my own walk with grief, I was that person. I always questioned and second guessed myself. I don't know what to say. So actually, I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to bring it up, right? It's so uncomfortable. But I had this one friend who a couple of weeks after the funeral called me and said, hey, I'm going to be flying down to Atlanta from Washington, D.C. I'm letting you know, right? And I was like, oh, no, you don't need to do that, right? She showed up. This friend showed up with her little dog in tow, and she was in my doorstep. Like, I knew she was coming, but she said, I'm just here to cook you some meals, and I'll walk the dog. And she was just there. She didn't ask me too many questions. It was just, I'm here to handle the basics. Mm-hmm. What kind of fish do you like, right? So she made my meals and she never pushed me to open up, but I inadvertently, I found myself opening up and she was just there to listen and she did not judge no matter what came out of my mouth in those early weeks and months. And I was so grateful for that friend and that just meant so much to me. And it was so helpful. It was a lot more helpful than, you know, somebody sending me constant Bible verses, because at that time, that's not the time. I don't know how you felt, but that just was not the time for me. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But that friend who just said, I'm just going to be here. I'm just going to do the basic things. And that is it. I'm not trying to put pressure on you to talk about anything. I don't even have anything to say about that because I don't know what to say. I'm just here to do the basics for you. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Keyword, show up. She just showed up. And whatever you needed, she was there in your space and showed up for you at a very vulnerable moment in your life. And I think so often, if there is a message out here that we can share from this podcast, is when people are grieving, they just need someone just to show up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I know that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
I know that's what I needed on many different occasions. And it's ironic that you say that, Bethel, because I remember when my son passed away, I have a college friend. She says, "Sis, I'm not coming to the funeral. My sister and my mother will be there for you. And I will be there the week after the service is over to stay with you. And I am here to tell you, Bethel, that was the most appreciated time." Not to say I didn't appreciate all the other visits I had leading up to the funeral, the day of the funeral, but she being here for me for that week was very helpful, very beneficial, and something that I will never forget. So I completely understand when you said that your friend just showed up with her dog and was there for you. So I definitely get it. Yeah, I definitely get it.
Because those calls and texts slow down after the funeral.
say that one more time.
The calls and texts slow down after the funeral, right?
Yeah.
It starts to get very quiet.
It does. And then once again, we're back into our own sense of isolation and our own thoughts. I remember telling people, if I don't want to be bothered, I'll tell you. But I would love a phone call. I would love the day somebody would just come knock at my door. And there was many days that didn't happen, you know. So I definitely understand what you mean when you say things just tend to start to mellow out.
I don't know if this was right before the funeral. I think it was right before the funeral. I was getting a lot of calls and texts then. And I got this one call, a friend that I was close to in college, but I hadn't talked to in a couple of years. And I picked up and she's like, "Oh, I didn't think you'd pick up."
So my question would have been, so what are you calling for? what was your whole purpose of calling?
But, you know, when we laugh about it now, but again, it is so uncomfortable. And, you know, and that friend was a younger friend. So again, these are things that as we experience these life events, I think we get new insights. I think it's just one of those difficult things, not knowing what to say.
As this subject is yet so uncomfortable, it is real.
Yeah.
And I always believe that in order to get a sense of comfort, if that's an okay word to use, we have to place ourselves in very uncomfortable situations. We have to place ourselves in very uncomfortable conversations. And this is one, right? Mm-hmm. And so hopefully the messages that are being spread on this podcast will give people an opportunity to begin to get as comfortable, if that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. And because Keisha, I guess the question is, we know it's uncomfortable, but uncomfortable for whom?
There you go. Oftentimes, good question.
It's the person who has not experienced it, right? Because us on this side, and I have another example here. One friend called me, I think it was a day before. It was a significant day. I think it was the first wedding anniversary after David passed. And I had seen her and we'd talked some. And in the middle of the conversation, after we'd sort of hit the small talk, she said, "Hey, I know what tomorrow is. I wasn't sure if I should bring it up." And then I said, "Yeah, I know what tomorrow is. And I don't stop thinking about it." Right. So right there, from her perspective, she thought she was bringing something up that could cause discomfort. But the fact is, the discomfort is my reality in the present. To me, I don't place it in the bucket of discomfort. It's just my reality. So all of the, you know, trigger dates and triggers, the ambushes, all of that grief terminology, that is my day in, day out reality. But when it's not your day in, day out reality, then it seems as if you may be the one triggering it, right? And you might have that perception, and that's really not the case. So all of this to say, I think now as friends start experiencing grief, whether it's, you know, loss of a parent or whatever the case may be, I'm that person who calls hoping you pick up, actually, right? I have now the capacity to be in that space with you. And I don't even call it discomfort. I want to be there to help hold you up. And you kind of reframe it now. It's not a discomfort thing. No, now it's familiar. It's familiar. And you've talked about it enough. You've sat with it enough that now you're showing up differently.
Yeah. So Bethel, you brought up something, and I want to touch on this because as our listeners are listening, they also need a sense of inspiration as they're walking this life of grief. You brought up anniversary date. You brought up your first anniversary. How is that for you?
Mm. 3.5 years later, it's still hard. And I know you're very familiar with grief. And I'm at this place now where I know and I accept that grief and joy can coexist. And I live in this dual reality where I'm able to ground myself in the present, but I often have moments of intense grief where those waves just come. But now I know that these are temporary. They're waves, right? So they crash with force, but they also subside. Mm-hmm. So when triggers come, and they come sometimes at the weirdest moments, unexpected ones, as well as the dates that are always going to be the trigger dates, I allow myself to feel those emotions. And I also know that grief is real because love is real. And I will always love David. Therefore, I accept that grieving him is now part of life. It's now familiar, right? And that makes it seem easier, not because it shrinks, right, but because my capacity to navigate it is better, right? Mm-hmm. Now I have perspective. Mm-hmm. Now I can kind of cope differently. I can sort of not control my emotions, but I know when to regulate my emotions. Mm-hmm. And that's not always possible. I find myself crying and laughing in the same sentence sometimes. But you know what? For me, that's okay. And that's normal. And I normalize my grief, and I allow myself to show up fully as my whole entire self, which is somebody who has a personality where I laugh a lot. But I'm also, that same person is also very emotional. And when I feel my grief, it means I'm feeling, you know, the love I still have. And those moments coincide. And you just, that's just how life is now, right? And I don't know what your experience is, Keisha, but I've kind of accepted that this is life going forward. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It just means that the love is still there and always be there. And I'm thinking about it not as something to be ashamed of or to hide or, right? I accept that fully as part of the experience of life.
Yeah, I think you summarize exactly what I see grief as. I see grief as grief for what the Webster Dictionary says it is, right? But for Keisha, I see grief as an opportunity to relive moments that were great that I can still hold on to. I see grief for Keisha as being able to hold on to the love, not just of my significant other, but all those of my life whom I have lost, whether it's by death, whether it's by divorce, whatever. I hold on to that. That keeps me grounded because it is my life. It is my norm.
Good.
I want to circle back for a second, because I know that throughout the podcast, you talked a lot about your faith, when you were heavy in your faith and when you begin to question your faith. How does your relationship with God evolve through your husband's illness and after his passing?
That is such a good question. And I wish I could tell you that I went through this whole process as some of the saints, or like Job did in the Bible, but that is not my story. I held on to faith like dear life when David was alive, because to me, my faith gave me hope. At the end of it all, when I'm just left with brokenness and I found myself a widow, it was hard to hold on to that faith, right? And I'm going to be honest with you. I got to the very edge of faith where I questioned everything, even the things that I thought I knew of God, right? I wrestled with my faith. I questioned everything that I thought I knew of God. And it wasn't always safe to ask those questions out loud, because people are very quick to defend God. But what I learned is that actually our faith is not too fragile that it can't be questioned, right? And it's in that wrestling we can actually unpack and see either a different way to think about our faith. And in my case, I ultimately got to the point of, you know, I'm not going to find the answers, right? I can ask all these questions, and I wrestled with them for a very long time, but ultimately settled on understanding that there's just things I'm never going to understand, at least not on this side of eternity. But I will tell you this, it wasn't because of people saying what they thought God's purpose was by doing that. I think a lot of times we try to find an answer, and I realize actually the answer is that there is no answer,
right?
At least not yet. And I found a way to accept that. So now even faith is a journey, right? And I'm still on it. So that's the good news. I am still on it, right?
And that's always good. Yeah. Beth, I think you bring up a good point, right? When we talk about what to say, what not to say, oftentimes you may hear people say, and it may have not happened to Beth though, right? But it does happen. So I want to bring this up here in this podcast. People may say, but God needed him more.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in my grief, I don't feel that way. To hear someone say that, it's tough, right? Or pray about it. Well, again, ma'am, sir, you don't know where I am right now dealing with my faith. To tell me to pray about it is not the answer either. And I think, again, because it is so uncomfortable for people, they say what they normally say in general conversations, not knowing that in the grief moment, some of those things that you normally hear or say is not acceptable or appropriate at that time.
Yeah.
So, Bethel, as we are getting closer to the end of the podcast, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your book, because I heard so many great things. And I'm sure our listeners are like, I can't wait to get a copy of the book. But I want to ask about the journey in writing your book. So how did writing your book play into your healing journey?
It was complicated. And the book is split into two parts. The first part is the love story. It is sharing David and that whole journey of falling in love and the very foundation of the thing that kept us going for all those years. And then in a way that is the other side of the coin on this grief journey now, right? I think that was important to share. So the first part is sharing that the Cinderella story, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second part was the reflection. And I had been journaling, you know, through that first year and a half, again, in isolation between my grief counselor. It was mostly me in my head and me in my journal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I had written so much detail about those raw emotions and the struggles, the questions. I had nowhere else to put them or no one to pose them to. So I would put all that in the journal. So I was able to, and this is, it was me being very vulnerable, because I thought that really going behind the curtain and seeing somebody's raw, vulnerable, messy journey through grief is really the heart of what can help someone, because it's great to celebrate the victory, but I have a greater appreciation when I see how far you've come. But more so, my second question would be, well, how did you do it, right? And that was something that I was searching for when I was newly widowed. A lot of people talk about, you know, triumph, resilience. That's great. But my question is how, and I need you to be honest and not just tell me the pretty things. Right. So that's partly what the book does. And then obviously I do get to a point where I do get perspective. I get those inflection points, those turning points, those aha moments, and I capture those. Right. And that's where I think those insights can be applicable to somebody who's stuck. I mentioned I was stuck for a long time, right? And I offer, well, here's another perspective. That really is the purpose for writing the book. There were parts that were cathartic because it allowed me to process things as I thought about them again and again and again. And then there were times where reliving the trauma, reliving the tragedy made me just even more sad, right? So I went through all of those emotions in the process of this book.
Which allowed you to walk the healing journey, I'm sure.
Yes. You know, writing this book, it was also a journey that took a year and change, I think almost 18 months. And for a few of those months, I was stuck because I was questioning, well, how does this end? Mm-hmm. Right? I could tell you about all of the things that's happened up until now, but how does this end? And that's when I forced myself to go deep and get to a place of understanding that it doesn't end. It takes me back to what I said before. It's the place of accepting dual reality. Grief doesn't end, and we move forward with it.
One question I always ask my guest, and I tailor it to the episode. What is one heart-to-heart message that you would give to a widow?
My heart-to-heart message for a widow, one is, firstly, I wish I could give them a virtual hug. And I just wanted to say that you are not alone. And as you walk through this journey of widowhood and grief, I hope that you have compassion on yourself and know that just as grieving is a natural response to love, that grief being now part of life going forward can still coexist with the beauty that is still to come. And I think a lot of times, and I was guilty of this, I wanted to hide and wait until everything was fixed and it got better, until I realized that grief profoundly changes us. And it's just love that has evolved into something else. And as you continue the journey ahead, just know that your expression of grief, the emotions that come is simply because that love is still there.
And that is a heart to heart. So Bethel, I want to give you an opportunity to share with our listeners where they can find you, your social media handles. And as we know, your book is not a Cinderella story.
Yes. So the book comes out the first week of January, and you can sign up for updates on my website. It's called reimaginedjourneys.com. Journeys is with an S, reimaginedjourneys.com. That's where I post updates and have a little countdown to when the book launches. But I'm going to be sending a link to everybody who signs up when that book becomes available for purchase. So please sign up there. And then feel free to follow me or reach out to me on social media. My handle is Bethel_Stevens.
We want to thank you for being a guest on Heart to Heart with Keisha B. Bethel, I must say that you have been an inspiration to me today. And I am quite sure that you have been an inspiration to our listeners.
Thank you, Keisha. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Heart with Keisha B. Remember, grief may shape our journey, but it doesn't define who we are. Healing is not a straight path, but with every step forward, you're creating space for hope, strength, and new beginnings. If today's episode brought you comfort or clarity, share it with someone who might need it too. Let's continue building this community of compassion and resilience together. Until next time, take care of your heart, your mind, and your soul. Honor your journey and always know that brighter days are ahead. I am Keisha B., and this has been Heart to Heart.